communities like Shaktulik and Gullivan, they are not part of that list. Where do we get funds?
The Army Corps of Engineers gets new mandates for funding coastal erosion mitigation efforts. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 23rd of June. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a unique training opportunity for military in Alaska.
We have fought the seas, the rain, the wind.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by North Rim Bank, helping you get from where you are to where you want to be. Achieve more. North Rim Bank for Business. Information at northrim.com. Member FDIC. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
A new law affecting funding for coastal erosion and storm damage protection efforts went into effect this month. In 2009, Congress repealed a previous version of the law known as Section 117. That law provided federal funding at 100% of the cost for planning, design, and construction of erosion mitigation and storm protection efforts. The new law, Section 116, will dramatically change the funding formula, requiring local and state matching funds at 50% for project planning and 35% for design and construction. The Army Corps of Engineers heads up these projects, and Section 116 gives them the authority, but not the money, to do so. Stephen Boardman is Chief of Civil Project Management with the Army Corps in Alaska. He says design and construction costs can cost tens of millions of dollars, and most communities won't be able to come up with the 35% required.
The work that we're doing at Kevalina, Shishmaref, Unalakleet are in the $20 to $30 million range, just to put protective stone out there. Newtok, the work we're doing for Newtok is design and an evacuation road, possibly ultimately evacuation center, but that's only a small piece of the overall project that the community is working on.
He says a baseline assessment of coastal communities found 178 villages had some level of erosion and 26 have urgent and compelling needs. The Corps has $5.5 million to work on projects in 9 communities, but no money beyond that yet for others.
So communities like Shaktulik and Gullivan, they are not part of that list. Where do we get funds? So we are in dialogue with the state of Alaska with this new guidance, working on strategies and how the state of Alaska will help fund some of these efforts. Whether they fund it in part or in total is yet to be determined.
We don't believe that the state of Alaska, and that is the general fund of the legislature, should be responsible for the entire amount.
Mike Black is the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. Black says the Unalakleet project has the 35% funding requirement met through state appropriation, but he says state officials want local and regional contributions to help meet that funding match in the future.
In Kivalina's case, the Northwest Arctic Borough has the possibility of being able to contribute. And that would be true also in the case of Unalakleet, where we might be looking at some contributions from not only the city, but also from regional organizations such as the Norton Sound Economic Development Corporation. We might be looking at the Regional Native Corporation.
Black says the 65 federal, 35 local formula is still a good deal, and since it's the only deal, he says it's in the state's best interest to look for funding partnerships with other local and regional entities. But he says because of climate change, a hard look at which communities are imminently threatened is important.
We know we're in a changing environment. We have a lot less sea ice than what we had just 10 years ago, and we have a lot more susceptibility of infrastructure and communities to erosion and flooding. So I would certainly believe that it's worth us looking and trying to analyze this problem more than just what we have to do next year, but what are we looking at in 10 years?
The Army Corps' Boardman says although this will be a financial struggle for many communities, Section 116 does offer more options than the old formula. Private property can now be considered for protection efforts, a departure from the previous public property and facilities only mandate. 116 also removes project limits for storm damage reduction that were capped in the past at $3 million. Boardman says it's not yet clear how the funding formula change will impact or apply to village relocation proposals. Calls to city officials in Shishmaref and Unalakleet for comment were not returned. The village of Newtuck is facing one of the biggest erosion problems in the state, and the community is getting help moving to a new site from the Alaska National Guard and other military units. It's the second season for the work, which allows the military to help the community while gaining some valuable training. From Member Station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more.
Expect the Bethel Guard Hangar to be a busy spot this summer. The Army National Guard stationed in Bethel will be moving a lot of soldiers this summer with some help from their Black Hawk helicopter. Captain and pilot Michelle Edwards.
Our role is transportation for the Marines. All the engineers, all of the people setting up the groundwork for the new village of Newtuck.
The military is embarking on their second season of construction for the site called Mukhtagavik. The new location is being built up to relocate the people of Newtuck. That small village will soon disappear under the encroaching Ninglick River. Last year, a team of Marines set up a barge landing and a base camp there, but that's several miles away from where the new site will actually be located. Lieutenant Colonel Darren Richardson is the division commander and will be leading the mission on site.
The main focus is to get the road on the ground and to put as much gravel and matting down as we humanly can.
The Mukhtagavik site represents a new beginning for residents of Newtuck. For the Marines, though, it's a golden opportunity to toughen up soldiers and practice operating in remote locations. It's part of their innovative readiness training.
Most of the places our Marines are fighting in right now are fairly austere, dusty, dry, and dirty. So a little cold, rainy Alaskan wilderness is good training.
Richardson says that Alaskan travel issues have already surfaced and delayed the start of work.
It's been a challenge. We had some aircraft issues. We have fought the seas, the rain, the wind. So unfortunately, it's been a bit of a slower start.
That's all part of the challenge they're looking for, says Sergeant Major Brian McCoyick.
In this environment, being at the far end of the food chain, we're dependent on boats, we're dependent on helicopters because we can't just load it on a truck and take it out there.
The effort also enlists the ranks of Navy and Air Force, who will assist with boat and barge support and provide necessities like meals and health care.
Anytime you can do joint service work, much like Afghanistan and Iraq, Africa, that's the best. You know, it's the way to go. It's the way of the future, and that's how we fight now.
Sergeant McCoyick says after a summer at Mukhtagavik, he hopes to have a unit that's prepared for the demands of a 21st century military.
The training, the experience, some of these Marines have never been deployed overseas, especially good for the heavy equipment operators to work within their job skill set to lay down roads, because that's things we also do in Iraq and Afghanistan.
U.S. military will be stationed at Mukhtagavik through mid to late August of this year. I'm Shane Iverson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, trying to turn around the sluggish economy in Angoon.
We're struggling. We're at half the customers we had 3 years ago, and we're at half the season.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by North Rim Bank, helping you get from where you are to where you want to be. Achieve more. North Rim Bank for Business. Information at northrim.com. Member FDIC.
Chilling effect was a phrase heard over and over again at a conference on 8A contracting that wrapped up today in downtown Anchorage. Under the Small Business Administration's 8A law, Alaska Native corporations have been able to go after no-bid government contracts worth millions of dollars. But the corporations are worried about a new rule that will require government contracting officers to provide justification for no-bid contracts over $20 million. The contracts will also have to be signed off on by the head of the agency awarding the contract. Clyde Gooden is vice president for NANA Development Corporation.
It's like going to Grandpa, and Grandpa's already got a full plate. Now you have to review my jobs, my contracts that you've already hired me for. So now you've added another layer of time and effort that gets in there. So it could slow down the government depending on what kind of effort they have out there.
Gooden says the provision was shoved through Congress with no input from Native organizations or the government agencies that will be affected by it. Congress scrutinized the ANC's unique provisions under 8A after other minority-owned small businesses complained the Native companies had an unfair advantage. Ron Perry is president of the National 8A Association. He says the new rule adds an unnecessary level of bureaucratic red tape. And he says corporations are already battling the false notion that the $20 million figure is a cap.
Anytime you say that there's going to be a cap, the word cap infers that that's it, that's the finish. That's not necessarily the case here. It isn't a cap. Cap is the wrong word. It's a threshold. Having to do authorization and justification for anything over a $20 million procurement is going to be more burdensome on the people who need these services than before.
The provision is the only certain change Native corporations are facing in the 8A contracting law. There are many other proposed revisions that would also limit Native corporations' participation in the program. Jana Turvey is Vice President of Corporate Affairs for Afognak Corporation. She says Native organizations need to get the word out on why that shouldn't happen.
We have positive stories to tell. We do great work. We're providing wonderful benefits to hundreds of shareholders at the Afognak level, and many Native organizations represent thousands of shareholders. And to provide those continued benefits, to give those opportunities back to our shareholders, we need to make sure that the policymakers and other individuals understand the impact that we're having on these individuals' lives.
The new rule hasn't gone into effect yet. It will be implemented after a consultation period with tribes. The Southeast Alaska community of Angoon is trying to turn its economy around. The largely Tlingit village of about 450 residents has lost business as well as some of its population. The Angoon Community Association, the town's tribal government, convened an economic summit earlier this month to search for solutions. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld attended and has this story.
Our Heavenly Father, we look to you today. We ask you to give the blessing upon this economic summit so that everything will go well.
A prayer begins Angoon's Tribal Economic Summit. It's a gathering of local leaders, state and federal officials, and others searching for solutions for a town hit hard by changes in the fisheries, the price of oil, and the tourism industry.
We're struggling. We're at half the customers we had 3 years ago, and we're at half the season.
Dick Powers owns a lodge and a bed and breakfast. He's been in business for four decades, but he says this year could be his last.
You know, I'm not going to die, but the problem is it's going to take a bunch of jobs with it. It already has. This year, I'm going to hire half as many people from Angoon that I hired last year. That's not a good deal. These are good people. These are people that do a good job.
And they don't have a whole lot of other choices outside of a limited number of positions in government and the schools. The cold storage plant is long closed. Logging on nearby islands is limited, and many commercial fishermen have moved or left the business. Angoon's population has dropped by about a third in the past 20 years. State statistics show half the people of working age are unemployed, and locals say it's really more than 80%. John Moeller, the governor's rural affairs advisor, says it's an unfortunate situation.
It's the Aleuts and Southeast residents that are moving out at a faster rate between rural Alaska into the hub areas and into the urban areas than any other place in the state. So in other words, our kids are getting trained up, they're getting educated, and some of them are just simply moving because of lack of job opportunities and lack of jobs.
Angoon is not without prospects, particularly on the construction front. The Marine Highway Terminal is slated for improvements that will allow fast ferries to stop on their way between Juneau and Sitka. There's a plan to build an airport, and federal funds may allow for some road building and upgrades, but such projects generally provide short-term jobs that might not go to locals. Albert Howard is Angoon's mayor.
The only way anything positive is going to happen within our community for economic development is to bring the cost of electricity down.
Howard is among those advocating city involvement in the Ruth Lake Power Project north of Petersburg. That's a controversial plan that we'll delve into in a separate report. Closer to home is Thayer Lake, a smaller hydroelectric development. The $20 million project has about $1 million in design money. And officials expected another million until Governor Sean Parnell vetoed half the funding for state renewable energy grants. Thayer is being developed by Kootsnuwu, Angoon's Village Native Corporation. General Manager Peter Nowrose says it's far enough along to focus on funding and getting the community behind it through a joint resolution of support.
Basically, this says the Angoon Community Association, Kootsnuwu, and the City of Angoon are working together to become energy independent and to use those resources which are traditionally in our territory. That's the bottom line. We were going to take care of ourselves.
Along with State and Forest Service officials, a key summit participant was U.S. Department of Commerce Senior Native Advisor Don Chapman. He spoke about the need for unity.
I come from Indian country. I know Indian country politics. I know small town politics. I know it's difficult, but it's very important you cooperate. I think one of the best things I heard today was the request to have all three groups meet, to get committees meet together on a regular basis. It's very important from a government funding perspective. We have to be coordinated on these efforts. We can't have three different groups applying for different types of funding for the same opportunity. It's a problem. It'll shoot down the funding.
Chapman has been meeting by phone with the Angoon Community Association, the tribal government that put on the summit, and he says he'll continue that effort in hopes of moving some of the projects along. That includes lowering the cost of power through the Thayer Hydro Project. Reporting from Angoon, I'm Ed Schoenfeld.
Anchorage police are investigating the death of a woman whose body was found in a tent. Police say the body of 39-year-old Betsy Chewett of Anchorage was found early Wednesday after her boyfriend, Christopher Lokanen, reported they had been sleeping after consuming alcohol. Lokanen said when he awoke, Chewett was dead. He also said she had been experiencing health problems. An autopsy is pending. It's the latest in a string of deaths involving the city's homeless. According to the Anchorage Daily News, more than 20 people have died in homeless camps, parks, woods, and trash bins over the past 13 months. Many of them have been intoxicated. By a nearly unanimous vote last night, the Anchorage Assembly approved a new ordinance for removing illegal homeless campsites and confiscating campers' property. But the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska says the law as passed is unconstitutional and they'll fight it. In April, ACLU Alaska filed suit against the municipality in Superior Court. The organization charged the city's 12-hour ordinance and lack of true legal protest against seizure and property destruction was unconstitutional. The city attorney's office proposed 5 days. ACLU wanted 10 business days. The director of the municipality's Health and Human Services Department, Diane Engel, supported the five-day guideline.
When you think about a public health perspective, really the longer time and the more time people have, the more time they have to disperse and go other places rather than for us to come in and our goal to really bring them to services.
After the vote, the ACLU's Jeffrey Mittman said his organization would now actively pursue its suit against the municipality in court. He said the homeless were entitled to constitutional protections against unfair seizure and destruction of property.
They've just passed a law that says the mayor's office has the right to decide your rights, and by throwing out your property as soon as the hearing officer decided, you effectively have no right to go to court. I can't think of any court in this country, any court in Alaska, that will approve of that. So they've basically passed, again, an unconstitutional ordinance, and on that grounds, the ACLU has to fight this.
Mittman also said campers who were served notice but happened to be in custody at the time might not even learn of the abatement action until after they were released and their property already destroyed.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. In Alaska, more than 2,000 children are in need of foster homes, and more than 1,200 of those children are Alaska Native. These children need homes where they can learn who they are. Alaska Native foster homes can help pass on traditions, arts, and culture. Help keep Alaska's children safe and their heritage strong. Learn more at 800-478-7307. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
A wildfire about 10 miles south of Fairbanks is getting the attention of fire managers and local residents. The Willow Creek Fire is on the other side of the Tanana River from town on military land, but it's putting up a lot of smoke. And State Fire Information Officer Maggie Rogers says residents in the nearby Rosie Creek subdivision are getting a good look at it.
And that includes people being able to see flames. And there's been some concern about just the proximity on the part of the public.
Roger says winds have been pushing most of the smoke away from Fairbanks, and that while some locals may feel threatened, the fire is not expected to cross the river into inhabited areas.
In terms of the reality of it actually jumping the river, there's a considerable portion that they burned out between the fire and the river, and then the river is extremely wide, and then even across the river, there's kind of a willowy, boggy area.
Rogers says the aerially ignited burnout conducted last night eliminated about 500 acres of fuels as a buffer. She says there is unexploded ordnance in the fire area, and no firefighters are being put on the ground as a safety measure. A red flag warning is in effect for much of the interior due to low humidities. A long-standing hallmark of the Alaska Native Heritage Center in Anchorage is that visitors are treated to culture in action. That's just as true this summer, as a special project involving Southeast Alaska totem carvers gets underway. As part of our series on Alaska Native education, KSKA's Len Anderson went to the Heritage Center to learn more.
My name is David Boxley. I'm Simsian Eagle Clan from Metlakatla, Alaska.
Boxley, along with Haida brothers Joe and T.J. Young, are working on two of four house poles for the Southeast Longhouse on the Alaska Native Heritage Center grounds. The third carver is Israel Shotridge. One of his previous works dominates the interior entrance to the center's main building. Shotridge is absent today, but since March has been working in a second nearby tented workplace. He started early because he's doing a pair of poles. Like Shotridge, Boxley's work has gained him an international reputation as an artist and culture bearer. Boxley and the Young brothers received their British Columbia red cedar logs a little over a week ago and are into their rough cut. Each of the poles represents a different culture: Tlingit, Haida, Eyak, and Tsimshian. Boxley says each also represents a different aspect of traditional respect.
Mine is respect of the environment. Theirs is respect of family. The other guys are doing respect of culture and self.
So how is Boxley depicting respect for the environment within the totem tradition?
This guy is on this pole is singing. He's got a drum and a drumstick, and the four clans of my people, the eagle, raven, wolf, and killer whale, are located in different parts on this post, representing this land, sea, and air, the environment.
My name's Joe Young.
I'm from the Haida tribe. I was born into the Eagle clan, but got adopted into my grandfather's clan, which is Raven Yucalana.
Joe and TJ are busy roughing out the respective family pole.
My brother's working on the two hummingbirds in the ears, and then the main figure in here is the eagle, which is, you know, you'd see the wings and the head. And then in the stomach is the raven. He's upside down, and they're connecting tongues just to kind of symbolize like a marriage, or, you know, because we're only allowed to marry in the opposite clan, which is eagle and the raven.
Besides introducing visitors to totem carving, Boxley says the conversations can provide opportunities to correct misconceptions concerning the totems themselves.
People still think that they're, you know, religious things or gods or things like that. You know, it's surprising sometimes, but other times not surprising.
At the same time, Long says for the carvers, the poles can bring a certain spiritual quality.
I think every carver does feel that if you're, you know, you kind of feel a connection to all of your ancestors. They've sat down and thought of the design the same way you have.
It's not just the tourists who linger by the carvers. The staff are also drawn. Eleanor Haddon is from Southeast Alaska. She's the assistant curator for collections and exhibits and has worked at the Heritage Center for 6 years. Haddon says, for her, the House Pole Project is an exciting opportunity.
I have never seen a project from start to finish. I, on occasion, have seen the final carvings. I've seen the putting up of the totem poles, but I have never seen them actually working on it. So this is just the most special thing I've ever had.
Haddon watches the tourists looking at the carvers while a heritage intern answers a question. There's a lot of serious learning going on here, she says. Haddon then includes herself. I try to come out here every chance I get, just to ask questions. The four finished house poles will be put in place with accompanying ceremony and celebration in August. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. You can also find other stories in our year-long series on Alaska Native education. Follow us on Twitter at aprn. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Len Anderson in Anchorage, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA. If you've been through a lot of bad things and you feel like everyone would be better off without you, suicide isn't the answer. You're not alone. You have people who love you, and there is help. Call the Alaska Care Line at 1-877-266-HELP. Call, share, and live. If you're thinking about suicide, call for help at 1-877-266-HELP. This message sponsored by the Mindy Schloss Memorial Fund and the State of Alaska. In today's competitive business climate, the advantage lies in reducing cost and increasing efficiencies. A safe and healthy workplace reduces cost and improves productivity. To get started, contact the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development's Occupational Safety and Health Consultation and Training Program at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.